Greetings and welcome to the Journal of Southern Religion podcast. My name is Art Remillard. I'm the book review editor for the JSR and I teach at St. Francis University in Loretto, Pennsylvania. Joining me today is Elaine Neal Orr, professor of English at North Carolina State University. She also serves on the faculty of the Brief Residency MFA in Writing program at Spalding University in Louisville. We will be discussing her debut novel, A Different Sun. Elaine, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, let's start with some background, because this novel comes out of your memoir, Gods of a Noonday. Can you tell us about the diary that your mother gave you and how that connects up to your biography and her biography and then ultimately this novel?
Sure. It was actually as I was writing the memoir that my mother gave me this diary. It was a copy, not the original, written by a woman who had been a Baptist missionary, just as my mother was, in Nigeria, where I was born, but 100 years earlier. So she had written this very sort of brief, evocative diary about her life in the 1850s in Nigeria. And it was very alluring to me, and it sort of filled in some things about my mother's life. And from the beginning, I felt a connection to this woman. And Lorana was her name.
Yeah, so Lorana Bowen's diary became kind of required reading for missionaries of your mother's age, right?
That's right. According to the story she told, which may have been a little bit embellished, but Lorana Bowen's diary was given to her and to other early missionaries, young missionaries, as a kind of way of saying, your life here in the 1950s is not so difficult because look what this other woman went through, no toilet, no running water, immense peril to body and soul. And so get a grip, your life is actually rather nice.
And when you read it, you said, and I'm quoting you here, "I found sentences so compressed, they seemed nearly to explode." And that she would use this language like she was feeling deeply wounded. And it seems like this compressed form of writing just begged you to turn to fiction. Is that accurate?
Well, yes. So after I published the memoir, and you're a writer, you're looking for another project. And I tried a couple of other things, looked at a couple of other things, but this diary really held on to me and I kept returning to it. And it was exactly those moments when she would write these just astonishing things, like feelings deeply wounded have been sad all day, but no further explanation. We don't know anything that's happened. I think that entry actually occurred the day before, the day after Christmas. So I was just compelled to think about it. And I'd also studied feminist criticism and thinking about the silences of women, what women don't write, right? And all that's been sort of lost to us. And I just began to imagine what in the world had occurred that she would write this, and also why she would not tell us more. And so I wanted to, in a way, help her tell her story. Of course, eventually it became my story, my imagined version of her life, which was also my imagined version in many ways of my mother's life.
I want to talk about the process of writing this, because you've written scholarly books, you've written two scholarly books, and then you turn to this memoir, and then you turn to fiction. And in writing this novel in particular, you had to take a different research approach in a way, where you traveled, where you read other fiction. And I'm wondering if you can talk about the challenge, because I can't imagine the challenge of moving from scholarly writing to fiction writing, and then you do it so well.
Well, I began actually writing poetry when I was doing my MA at the University of Louisville, and I might have carried on with that work, except that I had this sort of vision of myself standing on a street corner trying to hand out poems, and I thought, well, there's not much of a future here, so I better do something that will get me some health insurance. So I did like scholarship, because it's always been, to me, a kind of treasure hunt. The really cool thing about doing research for both memoir and fiction is that it really becomes a treasure hunt, where you get to go out, put your boots on, walk in the hills, Look for skeletons, you know, not literally, but sort of the skeleton in the closet. I mean, you get to go to Greensboro, Georgia. You get to go to Nigeria, to places, even though you grew up there, you'd never been, and try to find the creeks and take your shoes off and go wading and try to put yourself in the body of a woman 100 years, well, 150 years ago. So it's really, really fun. So I think the link is that research for me was always treasure hunting. And I was a little bit of a creative researcher always. So I was willing to take leaps of the imagination.
Before we get into the novel, I do want to get into one more important piece of background, which is that you are the daughter of medical missionaries, and you didn't come to the U.S. until you were 16. So this story is very much written into you. Can you talk about that experience and how that shaped the story?
Well, absolutely. Though, actually, we did come to the U.S. on furloughs. So my first memory of the U.S. is when I was 6 years old. Then we would go back and come back. But the U.S. was a place you visited. It was not a place you lived. So to me, it was always camping. Okay. Nigeria was home. Nigeria was the real world. It was clearly the better world. And it was where the gods dwelled, or God, any way you want to think of it. It was the way, it was the land of the divine for me. So my imagination growing up was shaped by living in primarily pretty traditional Nigerian towns, not Nigerian cities. I wasn't in Lagos or Abadan or Abuja, which is what people think of now. I might have been in a large town. It might have been 30,000 people, but it was a traditional town. So all the houses were mud houses, no two-story houses, no banks, no department stores, no movie theaters. You know, we were just there. And so my mind was just so enormously imprinted by especially Yoruba culture, which is the culture that I take my character to. And I take her there because she took herself there. I was going to take the reader there because I'm always going to take the reader there. I'm always writing transatlantic stories. That's where my heart is. And I want to spend a good deal of my time in West Africa and probably Nigeria.
Well, let's go there, but we've got to kind of start in the reverse direction because the main character in your story, Emma, starts in Georgia. We're in the 1840s. And she hears that classic line from Isaiah, "Here I am, send me." And so here's this, you know, educated, motivated woman. She wants to do something, and then a man enters the picture. Can you kind of tell us, about
absolutely.
That?
So just to help everyone connect the dots here, Emma is my fictional character who is my vision of Lorana Bowen. And so she's born onto a plantation in Georgia. Her father's very wealthy. She's deeply impressed by this old African who is allowed to live in a cabin in the sort of in the backyard of the house. And he's allowed to do this because he's elderly and he's a carpenter. And she's the younger daughter and she's an outdoors girl. That little bit comes from me, I think. And she spends more time with him than she does with anyone in her family. And so he, just as I mentioned how Yoruba land shaped my head, he shapes her head. And let me interject that in Yoruba land, the idea of the head is really the soul. Okay, so when you say that someone shaped your head, you're saying they shaped your soul. So he's deeply influential in her life. But she does love her father, and she loves her family, and she's very smart, and she has ambition. She wants to ride and draw and do all kinds of creative things, and she wants to ride a horse like a boy would ride a horse. But at a pivotal moment in her life, I think she's maybe 8 or 9, a horrible punishment is given to Uncle Eli for a crime he didn't commit. And in fact, there really wasn't a crime. And this in some ways alienates Emma from her family and her father. And for me, it's a deeply motivating moment in her life. She doesn't yet know what she's motivated for because of a girl in Georgia in the 1840s. What's she going to be? She's the daughter of a plantation owner. She's going to be married to a plantation owner or a planter, or at the very least, a wealthy businessman, such as her brothers became. So instead, she goes off to college, and she has this deep motivation, but she doesn't know what it's going to be for. And eventually, this handsome former Texas Ranger who has become a missionary and already been in Africa shows up in her church, and she is ready for him. And he sees in her a spark. She's not beautiful, but he can tell that she's lively. And he proposes, and off they go.
And off they go to Africa. And you see so many expectations meeting reality. And probably one of the biggest ones that struck me was race. That Emma is, you know, not used to black men not looking away.
Exactly.
And the norms that she is accustomed to don't exist there. And can you talk about how you set that up?
So Emma gets there, and she thinks she'll be welcomed. And in some ways, she is welcomed by people who have a little bit of experience with Europeans or Americans. But for the most part, the folks she encounters on the road or once they start their caravan up country find her frightening to look at. They think her skin is abnormal. She, being a sort of plain girl from Georgia, she thought she might come to Africa and be beautiful. And to her chagrin, she learns that she's not. And no one is afraid to stand up to her. So this girl who thinks she's rather open-minded for her time, gets to Africa and is very, very surprised that she is actually not above these people and that they do not see her as a superior. It's shocking to her, and she makes lots of mistakes. But she's eager, and she's committed, and so she keeps trying.
Well, and her and Henry kind of go over there with preconceived notions of how they're going to bring the gospel, right, to these to these people. But they find out, as you say, that every man was the theologian. And that causes, for both of them, for Henry and Emma, real reasons to reflect.
Yes, exactly. I mean, as I said, Henry's already been there, so he already knows that the Yoruba are monotheistic. They believe in one God. The problem for him is that they have all these divinities, right? All these sub-gods who are mediators between them and the divine. And so he's trying to help them get rid of all those. And Emma is just surprised at the way in which these people that she would think of not only as lost in terms of religious enlightenment, but she would think of them as not even quite as intelligent as she is, in fact, not nearly as intelligent as she is, that they have immense knowledge, that they're a highly developed culture, that they exercise arts and theology and music and agriculture and all kinds of things. And so they always have an answer for her and for Henry, and are often beating them at their in their discussions. I don't guess beating is quite the right word, but leaving them a little speechless with their acumen.
And Jacob really plays a critical role in this. And Jacob is sort of Henry's helper, right?
Yes.
And they develop a relationship as well as Emma develops a relationship. And in a way, I see him enabling both of them to reflect on who they are and where their kind of shortcomings might be. And makes sense.
Yes. Well, one thing that happens is that Henry begins to be ill rather often. He's already experienced significant bouts of malaria. One of the challenges of writing the novel, by the way, was that I couldn't name most of the diseases because they had not been diagnosed. People didn't know the treatment, for example. So I couldn't talk about hepatitis or malaria, certainly not post-traumatic stress syndrome, which Henry might have from his time in the Texas Cavalry. But he begins to be probably suffer from what we would now know to be cerebral malaria. And so he has some hallucinations. And more and more, both of them depend on his assistant, Jacob. And Jacob has been not only educated in traditional Yoruba culture and ways of knowing, he's been educated by the British. And so he is a formidable person in Emma's landscape, especially. She is really unsure what to do with this man who is, I have to say, good looking and intelligent in two worlds, whereas she's, you know, just learning in this world, new world. And so he has sympathy for both of them, but he's also able to see their faults. And his function in the novel really is to throw into relief their shortcomings. It was very important to me to write this novel with a point of view that was looking at these white missionaries and letting the reader know what they looked like from a perspective that begins in Africa. And that was a risk for me to write the point of view of an African man, a Yoruba man in 1853, but I thought it was so, so important.
Well, I wondered about this because I'm the name Jacob translates to God wrestler. And I'm wondering if that was an intentional move on your point, because I see this whole story as kind of a quest narrative, right? That somebody is called to do something. They go, they encounter this stranger, they wrestle with the stranger, they wrestle with themselves, and they come out with some sort of moral epiphany as a result. Was that an intentional move on your part? Or am I just reading too much into it?
So. I'm so thrilled. I think that I must have been being guided by some higher power in selecting that name. I went round and round about his name, and I can't even remember. I think I'd tried Daniel. There's the practice, of course, when a person in West Africa is baptized and joins the church, of being given a biblical name. And Jacob was baptized when he was being educated by the British. And we learned that, of course, he doesn't give up his traditional ways entirely. But that's the reason for his Christian name, whereas his younger brother has a Yoruba name. But I'm thrilled to learn this. Thank you so much. I love your interpretation.
Well, that's the great thing about fiction, right?
Yeah, it is the great thing about fiction. You're still learning about what you've chosen. And once you hand it over to the world, of course, readers get to bring news to your work that you didn't even know was there.
Now, I want to think about how this ends. I don't want to give too much away in the novel, but long story short, you have somebody in Emma at the end thinking back to Eli. And Eli is this sort of ghostly figure through the whole process, right? That he had come over from Africa. He had been enslaved. He had been treated rather poorly. Emma knew this, but she didn't really know it until I think in many ways Jacob and her time in Africa revealed what she calls, quote, the deep scandal of her life, or what you call the deep scandal of her life. And can you talk about how she basically comes to this point that by losing her way, she's able to have a kind of transformed view of the world?
Yes, as you mentioned, Uncle Eli is hovering through the novel. He keeps sort of showing up in the reader's mind, because he's given Emma this gift that is to her indecipherable. It's a carving. I mentioned that he was a carpenter. He's given her a carving, and she's taken it to be a utilitarian object, a letter opener, and she's been carrying it in her writing box through everything. And so it keeps showing up, and then at moments she'll see an old gentleman and she'll think, oh, it's Uncle Eli. And then finally at some point he dies and she gets a letter from her mother, and so he's now dead. So, but he's shadowing the novel. As you said, he's a ghost. We don't really, I'm thinking the reader doesn't quite know what his significance is, and Emma doesn't either. She thinks he's just this kindly, sweet old man from her home who was mistreated. She has no idea of his power. And ultimately, when Henry is incredibly ill and Emma's like 8 months pregnant, and she has no one in her known world but Jacob to rely on, he suggests to her that they might employ a traditional healer, a Babalawa. And in the process of Emma's seeking out this native healer, she herself comes to know something about Uncle Eli and his origins and where she has come. And in telling Jacob about that, he confronts her and causes really Emma's epiphany, her deep awareness of her own history and where she has come from and all the privilege she has carried with her to Africa. She has thought she came to Africa sacrificing her life, and in fact, she came and found it.
And I want to think about this line that you have in here where there's this discussion about Jesus in Africa, and you have Jacob saying, oh no, Jesus is the color of the earth. And I love that line, and I'm wondering if you could tell me where that came from, because that was a wonderfully creative way of thinking about that?
Well, it came from my imagination. So, as you said, Emma begins her journey from the U.S., from Georgia, and goes to Africa. But my journey in my life begins in Africa and comes to the U.S. And so I'm always motivated to show readers what the world looks like from a perspective in Africa. And Jacob at that point is having a conversation with one of his friends. And the friend thinks that Jesus is an Oyibo, a white man. And Jacob is correcting him. And that's sort of my little moment to correct anyone's theology who thinks Jesus is white by saying, no, Jesus is the color of the earth. And he even tells his friend, you know, Jesus lived in Africa, in Egypt. He has lived in Africa and he has never lived in North America. And so I'm having a little bit of fun there with that moment, which is also meant to be profound, right? It really is meant to be taken seriously.
Absolutely. Well, let me ask you one last question before we let go. So you spent, what, 5 or 6 years writing this, right?
At least six, yes.
At least 6 years. I'm imagining that letting go must have been very difficult, but I also imagine that you still think about these characters. And so when you think about these characters, what does their life become in the sequel? Where do they go when they get back to Georgia?
Oh, I can't tell you that. I cannot tell you that. Okay. I cannot tell you that. What I can say is absolutely I think of them. And I have thought of some way of picking up some character out of this novel and going forward. It wouldn't be exactly a sequel, but there might be a trilogy of novels that are somehow linked. And so I love to think, and I've heard from many readers, that their own imaginations continue to follow these characters out of the book. The book, it ends with, I hope, readers wanting a little more. I think that's always a good place to end.
It's always a great place to end, and we will end there. Again, the novel is A Different Sun. To learn more about the author, please visit her website at elaineneilorr.net. We will have it linked to the JSR website at jsr.fsu.edu. Thank you to Elaine Neil Orr for joining us, and thank you for listening. Have a great day.